Linoleum Knife.
A podcast of the cinema.
Where you can wiggle it just a little
Don't
bit.
Don't stop. No wiggling. Behave. You're Dave White.
Do you remember that song?
What?
Do you remember that song?
Wiggle it just a little?
Yeah.
I do not know that song.
It was just it's terrible.
Oh, good.
Yeah. And it's from the great year of music, 1990. A house song, but also
it came out in 1990.
With rapping.
So. Oh,
hip house.
Great.
Is what they used to call it back in that moment. That was not a thing that ever happened. It was not a big hit. But the Chipmunks recorded it.
Oh, well then. That's how you know
the
it's
the original
good.
Artists were called Two, the number two,
uh-huh.
In a room.
Before they became Two Out of the Business.
Right. No, I just passed through this record store, I worked at, and we all listened to it, and we said, that sucks. It was mildly popular, I think. Maybe it wasn't a big hit.
Oh, but the house, you know, I still remember putting CNC Music Factory on a mixtape for one of my siblings, and my sister-in-law referring to it as that rap song. I'm like, wow. If you think Gonna Make You Sweat is a rap song, then we're in trouble.
Freedom here. Williams did some rapping on that.
Yes.
Record.
Ah, freedom. I know. You're Dave White. I'm Alonzo Durazzi.
So anyway, it goes, oh, wiggle it just a little bit. Remember that? You don't remember that at all?
Why don't you?
You were around when I was around.
I was elsewhere in 1990, not wiggling it, clearly. Or wiggling it on my own volition.
What's your
without
name?
Being
Introduce
told.
Yourself. Tell people
I'm trying
who you are.
To, but you're all talking right. about this stupid song. I'm Alonzo Duraldi. You're Dave White. We write for the rap. We're married to each other. We host this Fakakta podcast. And joining us today is Johnny Jungle Guts.
I'm here.
Hello, Johnny Jungle
to
Guts.
To talk about video games.
Yay.
They sound thrilled.
If you subscribe to Linoleum Knife anywhere, like Apple Podcasts or Spotify or whatever, you occasionally get a show called Super Gay, which Johnny co-hosts, and we're delighted to bring to the world. They also have their own feed, of course, but we also serve it up.
Thank you so much for putting us on the air, on the
articles,
RSS, the RSS feed. That's where it is.
It is our pleasure, sir.
So, I'm here to talk about Detective Pikachu. I remember Two Unlimited, but I don't remember Two in a Room. So much less than being unlimited.
Well, Two Unlimited dominated the...
The two wanted to get out of the room and be unlimited at some point, but it never happened.
Of all the bands that had the number two in their name, Two Unlimited, they were the champions of that.
Yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
They sure were.
And tonight is the night when two become one. I don't even know what we're talking about now. This is a podcast of the cinema.
We're
going
cinemas.
Down a rabbit hole of house tracks.
We have movies to talk about. The reason Johnny is our guest today is because he's the president of Pokemon.
I am. No, I'm the, like, who am I? I like to think of myself as the Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez of Pokemon.
Yeah, presidents are not
the best thing right
looking
now.
Real good these days.
But yeah, no, Johnny knows Pokemon in its many, in its forms, and the games, and the comics, and he did an exhaustive ranking of 22 Pokemon feature films for the rap. Go read that.
What a journey I went on.
Who knew there were 22 Pokemon feature
films? I did not know that there were 22. Now, when we say that there were 22 Pokemon films, do we mean that they were all theatrically released?
I believe that almost all of these films were theatrically released, either in many of them in limited release in the States,
okay,
and almost all of them in domestic release in Japan.
Right.
There's, you know how there's those anime films that like Fathom or somebody will show for one or two nights?
Yes.
Yes.
Sometimes those are Pokemon.
Yes, movies. They are.
Now, I do remember the original animated features that Warner Brothers dropped in the early 2000s. There were several of those.
Yes.
And they were theatrically released. They were wide releases.
I went to one of them
in the U.S. and I had to review all of them. Yeah. And each one of them just felt like more of yelling until Pikachu came along and just shot lightning out of his butt and vanquished the bad people.
Yeah, like if you only watch, like, you know, Studio Ghibli movies, there is that whole strain of anime, and I don't know if it's the original versions or just how they do them in English, but where the whole thing is like, oh no, look out,
know? Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So that's
Every line of dialogue in those early Pokemon movies had an exclamation point on it.
Pretty much. And when I knew that this was happening, I thought, oh, but I already did my time. Like, I gave already with this, because I was never a child for Pokemon. No, I was not even an older kid for Pokemon. This came along well into my adult life.
Yeah, we weren't even stoned college students.
Correct.
For Pokemon, like nothing.
So I missed it in many ways and had, frankly, no business reviewing those early features. If only for the purposes of saying what you're about to say about this film, and with regard to what fans want versus what studios need to give to people when they're offering the world a very wide release film.
And I think that you could even make a case for those Pokemon cartoons that they were just designed for fans. So that it wasn't for Joe moviegoer of, you know, over the age of 20 to wander in and be like, what is this mysterious world? You know, as opposed to this movie, which I think clearly is or should be, but isn't. I mean, I'm thinking that you can't make this movie that is clearly meant to sort of launch a whole line of these live action Pokemon hanging out with humans features and only appeal to fans. I'm thinking they have to be thinking that there is a segment of the audience that has to be sort of finessed into this, and they are not. But anyway, Johnny, why don't you explain the plot of Pokemon Detective Pikachu.
Yeah. Okay, so we sort of open up on this guy, Tim. He's an insurance salesman, which I kind of love. And his friend is trying to spark joy, as they say, in his little heart by taking him out into the woods and getting him to catch a Cubone, which is the least joyful Pokemon of all time. It wears its mother's skull on its head, so... not the smartest move there, kid. But so he tries to get Tim to become a Pokemon trainer again, and it doesn't really work out. And sort of learn that Tim has all this drama with his dad, who's kind of been distant because he's a detective. Then we find out the dad is dead, and Tim goes to Rhyme City, which is this sort of Pokemon utopia where there's not supposed to be any Pokemon battles. Which is kind of a smart way of handling the fact that in actual Pokemon trainers, owners are battling
all the time.
All the time, which just feels like, you know, can feel like to, if you think about it too much, it feels like some kind of horrible, animal rights dog fighting scenario going on. And it is. So they manage to avoid that by doing that. But so then he goes to Rhyme City and he meets Pikachu, and for some reason Pikachu is not only saying its name anymore, the voice of Pikachu, I'm going to mispronounce this, but her name is Ikui Utani, and she actually, I have to give her credit because she has learned to express a lot of different emotions by saying the word Pikachu over the years. But here, Pikachu sounds like Ryan Reynolds. She's also, when Ryan Reynolds isn't speaking, it is her again.
Tim hears Pikachu as Ryan Reynolds. Everyone else hears Pikachu as the original voice.
That's right. So then,
Tim is played by Justice Smith.
That's right. No relation to Will Smith.
No.
Tim and Pikachu set out to try to find his dad, who Pikachu is convinced is still alive, and that's the plot.
Yeah, then things.
Yeah.
And you know, so it's basically Roger Rabbit and a little Zootopia and
Golden Compass, you mentioned in your review, which I hadn't thought of.
Yeah, well, the way that Rhyme City works, because there are no battles, every human seems to have their own sort of accompanying Pokemon.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Why and to what end, I do not know, but there they are. And so, I was reminded of the Golden Compass and the His Dark Materials books.
Friendship.
Where everyone has a daemon.
Yeah. Friendship.
Everyone gets a friend. But they don't.
I think that's a nice world. That's a good life.
But I never see how they interact in a way that is friendly or mutually beneficial. It's like everybody has a somewhat headstrong and annoying pet that they just have all the time. Okay, Tim winds up working with this girl who is an intern at a CNN type network. And she has a Psyduck. I don't know. She does. And what does Psyduck do?
He goes,
It explodes when it gets upset. That seems like
when it gets a headache.
That seems like a high maintenance pet.
Yes.
Don't you have high maintenance friends?
Yeah, good point.
You have a high maintenance spouse.
Yeah, true.
So, you know, I think it's a nice world. I would not mind living there. I would like a Pokemon friend. You could teach them to do things, I guess.
What are some of your favorite animals, Dave?
I love puppies and kitties.
All right. Well, then you probably get a little...
I'm allergic to both, and I can't own either.
You can be more specific than that. What are some of your favorite breeds of dogs?
I like big, dumb dogs. And then I also like... Squatty dogs, like bulldogs and pugs and stuff like that.
Yeah, the Pokemon that you would have is called a Snubbull, and it's actually in the movie, I think.
Aren't they all in the movie? Don't you see like all 800 of them at some point in this film?
No.
I was noticing so many, and they were flying past on the screen. And
they sure were.
And I thought, if someone's going to count them.
Someone is going to count them, and that a little bit was me, and I will definitely say they were not all in this movie.
Okay.
But anyway,
What's your best, like, round guess?
Of how many Pokemon were in this movie? Yeah.
Different types.
Definitely over 100. Maybe 100. I don't know, but definitely not 800. Mm. Not anywhere close.
Snubbull is like a little pink bulldog-looking thing.
That's right. And he's a fairy type.
He's
also
adorable.
Just perfect for you.
He's a good color. Yeah. I'm into it.
Yeah, I think that would be your Pokemon.
Would he like me, do we think?
He's a little grumpy, but that's what's fun about him.
Oh, well, that's what's fun about you. That's what's fun about me, too.
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't know. So I went into this movie with an open mind. It's like, whenever I see video game movies, I take it for granted that I'm not going to get, like, the Easter eggs. I'm not going to get the inside jokes, and that's fine. Like, I was even worried going into Scott Pilgrim versus the World that I was going to be like, I don't know this milieu at all. Even though it's not directly based on a video game, it is couched in sort of video game, you know, language and structure and stuff. But, you know, and I love that movie, as it turns out. But so I went into this one knowing, okay, I'm not going to recognize Pokemon. I'm not going to get the jokes or whatever. But, like, if they can create a world that I'm interested in that I want to see unfold, then great. I found it really kind of often not great to look at. Like, it's shooting for this sort of Blade Runner-y kind of noir feel. But it just sort of feels overcast. I didn't think it was very funny. I didn't care about the main human character that much. I don't know. It just sort of it didn't wow me in any way.
I think the filmmakers probably said too. Ryan Reynolds, be Deadpool, but not
but
disgusting and kind of PG and for kids. And he tried. And, you know, I'm sure there was a lot of, you know, ad-libbing going on with dialogue. But you're right. It could have been funnier.
It could have been.
Yeah.
This is the thing, though. I hear what you're saying, and maybe I'm too critical of this movie, but I also feel like it didn't really do the job of conveying what's great about Pokemon. Because let me just sort of like
please tell
what
please tell us
is.
What that is.
Yes. Yeah. So do you remember being a kid and that sort of age where your parents are just letting you go do things outside of your house without, you know, them being completely on top of you? Maybe you're 8, maybe you're 12, right. Depends on the case. And so you get to go out into your back, you know, the woods in your backyard. In my case, it was a riverbank. So, and then, so you get to go down to the riverbank and you find a really cool turtle.
Mm-hmm.
Let's take the feeling of that, okay?
Yeah.
And add on to it that, like, the turtle is suddenly kind of your friend, and then like a bat shows up, and the turtle and the bat fight. The turtle protects you from the bat by shooting water out of its mouth, and then suddenly, after the bat loses in the water out of the mouth fight, the bat is your friend, and now you're chilling with the turtle and the bat. That's kind of like the energy of Pokemon. It's a sense of exploration in nature. And that's what the creator was trying to do, because Satoshi Tajiri, who created these games, was a bug collector when he was a kid. Mm-hmm. And he saw many of the places he went spelunking paved over. And so he wanted to, in a very sort of melancholy way, give Japanese children a sense of adventure in nature. This movie starts with a little of that, which I liked, right. And then quickly goes Blade Runner, which is exactly what you were talking about.
Yeah, and in fact, like, in addition to doing the ranking list for the rap, Johnny also reviewed the film for the rap, because I knew it couldn't just be me, you know. And so previously, when the Veronica Mars movie came out, when the Entourage movie came out, I reviewed them from the point of view of someone who had never seen the show before, and then I would have somebody who was a fan of the show write a separate review. I think I probably stole the idea from Entertainment Weekly years ago when the X-Files movie came out. Yep. They had two reviews, and I thought, well, that's clever, because there are people going to this movie who are like total fans and they want, you know, what they want, and then there's people who are going to be like, you know what, I'm a movie person, I don't watch this show, is there anything in it for me?
Right.
And I kind of feel like we both, I made it a point, after the movie, I was like, we're not talking about this.
Right, yeah.
We're going to go home and write our own reviews and post them. But I think we wound up kind of feeling the same way about it.
We did. I will say that there are a lot of fans online who are pretty happy with this movie, and I also noticed that there were a lot of fans online who were not thrilled with our reviews. Mm. I think that...
What? On the internet?
Yeah, which I thought was funny because the movie wasn't even really out yet. But what are you going to do?
Well, of course.
Yeah, no, yeah. No, nothing gets people madder than finding fault in an IP-based feature film that they haven't seen yet.
You monster.
That they're excited about. But no, I felt, you know... I didn't feel guilty about not liking the movie, because you also didn't like the movie. And if this movie isn't made for you, it's not made for anybody, you know?
They did do a good job designing these Pokemon, though. I am really happy with that, and I do think if they did more movies, there's space for that.
Yeah, because like...
Oh, they're going to do more.
Yeah, oh yeah.
Oh, sure, because yeah. I just looked at Box Office Mojo, and this
one's doing well.
This hauled it in this weekend.
Now, so, yeah. Do you remember, I think it was like Happy Feet 2 or something, yeah. had a Sylvester and Tweety cartoon attached where they were done as 3D characters, and like Sylvester had hair and Tweety had feathers.
I don't remember if I saw Happy Feet 2. I might have. I probably did.
I barely remember,
I don't
the movie.
Remember this.
I just the short is burned into my head because it was so creepy. It was so creepy to see these characters so delineated and realistic, and like the drool flying around and stuff out of Sylvester's mouth.
Right.
So this is that same kind of leap for Pokemon, and they're like, we've never really seen a furry Pikachu before, right?
Yeah, kind of not, because when you have a video game rendered character with sprites or even polygons or whatever, you don't usually render in the fur. And also in the anime, you might see a little tuft of hair on Pikachu's head every once in a while, but yeah, you don't really see how he's fuzzy.
Because it's always been like just 2D.
2D you know, flat, yeah, that kind of style of drawing.
So, but you didn't find it off-putting when they suddenly, now these guys have scales or whatever they have.
I mean, it was always going to be off-putting. I mean, Mr. Mime was terrifying. The Mime one, I don't remember him. And then Gengar's teeth, they really overdid. But they kind of had to do that. They kind of had to make these choices where... Like, okay, if this was a real thing, it would have a body part that was like this, you know? Like, you can't just totally just leave it up to the, you know, you have to make choices. And they, sure. They made some good ones. RJ Palmer is a very well-known Pokemon artist who did this just in drawing, rendering form before this movie came out. And they brought him on as a consultant. So that gave me... optimism, and I think they delivered.
Okay.
I didn't understand anything that was happening in this film. And I walked in thinking, I probably will not understand anything that's happening in this film. And so I drifted in and out of paying attention to it, knowing that, I had both of you there to do all of that heavy lifting for me. And consequently, when it was over, I thought, that was fine. I got about 40% of what was happening. I paid attention to about 70% of what was happening. And and it cost me nothing. So, my official film critic stance on this movie is, I don't care.
And I just want to say that Pokemon itself does not make any sense. Like, it's a great mechanic for a game. It's a lot of fun to play. But if you try to do a deep dive into what's really going on here, it doesn't make sense. It's like these animals have evolved to have a sort of symbiotic relationship with people, maybe. But it's like, it doesn't ever go that far in the game, really. And what also makes the anime a little bit better than this movie and most of the movies we watched is it's very down to earth when compared to other animes. There's no save the world thing.
Right.
There's none of that stuff.
Yeah.
And then when they do these movies like this movie or almost all the movies I reviewed, that's when they kick it into this like epic high gear and it kind of loses the fun a little bit. But anyway, we can stop talking about Pikachu. That's why I'm here, but you kind of have to cut me off.
Dave and I were at the movies this morning, and it was packed with little Pikachu. We were at a theater this morning.
We weren't at a movie. We were in a movie theater.
Yes, we went to see the Met in HD. I'd never been to one of these before. You know, the when they do the operas.
Oh, of course, yeah, those commercials before the movie.
Yes, right. So yeah, I posted a thing on. Instagram, and our friend Aaron said, oh, you're the one who goes to these. But they're popular. Like, we went to Burbank.
Well, because they're very popular with people older than us.
Yes, but like, we didn't go see it at our usual AMC in Century City because it was sold out.
True. Oh, we drove out to Burbank, where they stuck it in a little house, and they crammed all the old people in just right up next to us. And, that part of it was terrible.
Yes. A lot of cologne.
A lot of perfumes and a lot of inept phone usage so that, you know, the phone would go off and ring in the middle of the opera. And they're trying to turn it off. And like, oh, dear.
And the owner doesn't know how to turn off said phone.
Right.
We're not like, you know, casting blanket aspersions on old people in general.
I'm not ageist. The ones in the theater. I'm just saying.
This is what we observed.
There are characteristics of all. But in conclusion, even though I'm not going to go into it anymore, the next time I hear an old person yell about young people and their phones, I will go off. Because the behavior is equally bad, but for a whole other reason. Yeah.
But we got to see an opera about nuns being oppressed in the French Revolution, so woo!
Well, were they oppressed?
Well,
they were part of the...
They were part of the problem.
They were part of the problem.
We should all
go to the guillotine at the end of the opera, and you're like, well, you all kind of had it coming.
Yeah. Whose side were you on? We know.
Exactly. So, speaking of France,
yes,
let's talk about nonfiction.
Ooh, yes, a movie I saw last August.
Yeah, what do you remember?
I went back and reread my review. I still remember.
Why did you
well.
See it last August, Alonzo?
I was at the Venice Film Festival.
Someone
was at the Venice Film Festival. And being fancy.
Yes. So it
went at the screening that you went to at the Venice Film Festival in August of 2018.
Yes.
Were any of the cast members there? Olivier Assayas there?
I went to the press screening at 8:30 in the morning in the afternoon. I did not go to like the gala that evening.
Got it.
Where I'm sure Ms. Binoche was probably in attendance. Yeah, this is the new Olivier Assayas movie. It stars Juliette Binoche. It is about a sort of circle of friends and lovers Guillaume Canet plays a publisher who has a new consultant who's trying to push the publishing house further into digital and ebooks, and she's very modern. She thinks that Twitter is the new haiku, and of course they're having an affair.
They're having sex, yes.
He is married to Juliette Binoche, who is a serious actress, but she's been slumming it on some dumb cop show for several years. She is having an affair with an author who the publisher just turned down, even though that author's books are pretty much thinly veiled accounts of his own love affairs.
Played by an actor who's sort of up and coming in France right now. Vincent McKinney?
McKinney.
McKinney?
Yeah. I made the joke on Twitter that Vincent McKinney and Juliette Binoche, the subtitles version of Seth Rogen and Charlize Theron.
A little bit, yeah. There was an interesting interview that I read with him. I'm digressing here. I know we're going to talk about what the movie's about. An interview he gave not long ago where he talked about the economics of being a working actor.
Mm-hmm.
And just flat laid out his salary.
Wow.
And he said, oh, do you think I'm rich because I'm in movies and I write plays and I act on stage? I make about 2,500 euros a month.
Whoa.
That's not a lot of money. No.
This French guy.
Yeah. And I just thought that was like flabbergasting that he would just say these things out loud. Because you can't get any of them to say out loud what kind of money they make.
This movie reminded me a lot of Summer Hours in terms of it's kind of Assayas being the like, here's where we are, arts, you know, like Summer Hours is all about, you know, the nation's art treasures and who is going to take care of them when the next generation comes up. And, you know, is there going to be this sort of ongoing reverence and understanding of our culture, or is it just going to sort of dissipate with these awful kids who are all looking at their screens all the time? And this movie is sort of like, you know, wither literature, you know.
It is a film set in the literary world. And there isn't a real plot in terms of, you know,
story beats.
This happens, and because of these two things, this other thing happens.
Right.
It is absolutely a sort of roundabout where you go from character to character. That character is sleeping with another character, mm-hmm. and it's a secret, or it's not a secret, or they think no one knows, but everybody knows, or it was a secret, and now it's part of a novel.
Exactly. The author guy who's sleeping with Juliette Binoche also has a girlfriend who works for some idealistic politician and is younger than the other characters, well, except maybe for the digital lady.
And I want to say her name.
Okay.
The character's name is Valerie, but the actress's name is Nora Hamzawi.
Mm-hmm.
She's the scene stealer in this film. She is the most... first of all, she's the funniest person in the movie. Mm. And she is the most cut to the bone in terms of her responses to what anyone says to her. So when writer guy comes home and says, well, Guillaume Canet is not going to publish my manuscript. And she says, oh, did you hear from Selena? You know, his wife.
Uh-huh.
And he's like, did you hear me? He's not going to publish my book. And she's like, I heard you. What do you want me to do about it? And they go round and round and around. And she says, rework your text. He says, I worked on it a year. She said, do it again. She said, change publishers. He says, I don't know any other publishers. Like, find one. She said, do you want me to cheer you up? And he says, yes. And she says, no. And she walks out. And so
this is a comedy, and Juliette Binoche is funny in it, which she doesn't usually get to be in these movies.
You're right in that this is very much like Olivier Assayas' earlier film, Summer Hours, in that the pressures of global capitalism are pushing the arts into weird new shapes. And it makes people upset when they don't know where things are going, when they feel like they're losing something they held on to very tightly in the past. In this case, it's books.
Right.
And you have young, sort of future-looking people in the film talking about how, well, you know, libraries are going to be obsolete, and that's fine. We'll leave them in the dust.
Yeah.
And older people are saying, but, you know.
Yeah, literature.
And so there are so many other ideas going on in the film, specifically because no one stops talking. This is the most subtitle dense foreign language film I have seen since Sierra Nevada, which was, if you recall, you saw that with
me. I did not.
You did. You saw that with me. The 3-hour one about the Romanian film, about the family in the apartment.
Oh, yes. Okay. Right.
Also a comedy of sorts.
Right.
Where they never stop talking.
Yes.
And it's rat-a-tat-tat kind of dialogue. And that's the same way it is here, except here, it's not just interpersonal arguments. It's people throwing out ideas about culture and the future of it and arguing with each other about those ideas, but never coming to any conclusions.
Yeah, no, which is what I like. I like that he's raising the questions and he's exploring the questions, but he's not answering the questions. He's not here to tell you anything. He's here to be like, we need to think about this.
That's one of the things that I feel he's critical of. The characters are doing this. I don't think Olivier Assayas wants this.
Oh, you think he wants answers and he's mad the characters are not coming up with them?
Yeah, I think that because very often in the course of the film, a character will say something fairly incendiary to someone else about, you know, the future of art, the future of literature, the future of whatever. And invariably it's someone like Juliette Binoche who looks at them and says, oh, and you think that's good? And in one very specific scene, the guy says, oh, I don't feel anything about this. I'm just taking note. And her response is, well, that's easy, isn't it? It's a movie full of people who are jerks for the most part.
Yes.
And who offer no commitment to pushing for a better world. The young people think that the world is going to be better because of technology and how it's all going to save us. But all you got to do is look at the tech people in the world. And you'll know that that's not the way it's going to go. They all want to get rich.
Exactly.
They're not utopian people. They are capitalists. Yeah. And so this is one of the problems in the film that the film is, I think, exploring. And I don't think that Assayas is saying, well, you know, I'm just throwing it out there. I think he's angry at people who are saying, you know, I'm just throwing it out there, who offer no step two to get to the place where we all want to go.
Yeah, but I don't.
Which is a better world.
But I don't know that he knows the answers either.
No, he doesn't. Or else he might have a character that threw it in there.
Yeah.
But.
And I think
there's that frustration, I believe, within himself.
And no, absolutely. Yeah. But I think at the same time that if this were a movie that tried to provide answers, it would be, you know, old man yells at cloud. But because it doesn't, and because it doesn't attempt that, it, I think, is sort of, it's provocative. And it's, you know, it could end with somebody looking at the camera being like, what do you think? You now, when we reviewed it on Breakfast All Day, Matt actually talked about how, like, there was so much reading in this movie.
Yes.
Because there's so much dialogue. And so I would say, you know, if you can see this projected, you know, as opposed to, like, on your laptop, you'll be happy you did just because it's a lot.
Well, I did both. I went to the press screening. Mm-hmm. And I immediately texted the publicist after. And I said, will you send me a link for my laptop? Because the dialogue was so dense, and I didn't take notes fast enough. And I need to watch it again so I can take notes.
Right, but you had the one experience that
helped
your belt
me.
Already.
That helped me do that
for the souls who will see this movie one time.
Y'all just get yourself a publicist who's handling the film. Come on, it's not that hard. Just do it. Don't be so lazy about finding yourself a publicist who's handling the new Olivier Assayas film. Damn.
Anyway, you should see Nonfiction. It's pretty great.
I like it a lot.
Yeah.
And I like his films a lot. And in spite of the fact that they, you know, quite often are about the bougiest of people.
Yes.
Even if you don't like the movie, man, their houses
Those
are
apartments.
Yeah. Houses are great. Everything's just so, you know, lived in and sort of literary bohemia kind of people. It's nice. This is, you know,
if Joan Didion had the Sanctuary catalog.
They are the Sanctuary catalog. Do you remember what the Sanctuary
catalog was? Yes, it was the Cher catalog.
Okay, do you remember the things that were in the Sanctuary?
It was ridiculous, but terrible. But because it reflected Cher's taste, that's why I'm saying. If
what
Joan
was
Didion
this?
Did one.
Oh, if Joan Didion had her own catalog.
Version
of,
yes,
okay,
that's
I
what
understand.
I'm saying.
Got it. All right. Well, that didn't make sense.
The Sanctuary catalog, this was back in the 80s?
Yeah. Oh, Cher had a home furnishings catalog.
Oh, hell yeah.
It was all like, you know.
It was goth light.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
It was good.
I'm sure they're all online somewhere.
And probably, yeah. I'm a fan of him in the way that I think people used to be fans. And this is not, you know, I don't want to draw comparisons, but. People used to really love Woody Allen in the 1980s because his characters, you know, went round and round and round, mostly about love.
Yeah.
Esaias's characters go round and round and round in that same, you know, sophisticated, educated,
name-dropping philosophers kind of way.
Art-adjacent atmosphere about art and about culture.
Yeah. Yeah, there's a Romer vibe here for sure.
Yeah,
you know? Yeah, this is a great movie.
The Hustle.
Ooh, it's not a great movie.
It's not. But, well, okay, here's The Hustle. It's a remake of Dirty Rotten Scoundrels, which in itself was a remake of... Bedtime Story, a film I've never seen.
Which we got to watch. When I was growing up, there were like three movies... that my household would drop everything to watch or would stay up until ridiculously late hours to watch on, like, syndicated television in the pre-VCR era. One of them was Charade. One of them was We're No Angels with Humphrey Bogart, Peter Ustinov, and Aldo Rey. And one of them, heaven knows why, was Bedtime Story.
Right.
So the original version, it's David Niven in the what we might think of as the Michael Caine role from Dirty Rotten Scoundrels, and Marlon Brando in the Steve Martin role, and Shirley Jones as the Mark.
Right.
That they're both competing to win over. But yeah, so it's basically, but all three movies, they're set in the Riviera, they're about con artists.
This one stars Anne Hathaway and Rebel Wilson
yes.
as con artists who meet by chance and decide to, you know, work together. And then they set their sights on, you know, a variety of people.
Yes.
But specifically in the last half of the film, on a young tech billionaire.
Yes.
Who they are trying to play. Then feelings come into it and then surprises come into it.
And if you've seen Dirty Rotten Scoundrels, no surprises come into it because
correct.
It's a very direct remake.
As you said at the top, this is not a good film.
Yeah.
However, I had a good time.
I was not entertained.
Yeah.
Like, it opens with an animated opening credit sequence, which is so 1960s.
That's catnip for you.
Oh, totally. Yeah. I love, especially a heist movie with animated figures of the lead characters, like, picking each other's pockets and
right.
stuff. I live for this. So already I was feeling warmly toward this film as we were getting rolling.
And I'm a fan of both Rebel Wilson and Anne Hathaway.
Yeah.
I'll kind of follow Anne Hathaway anywhere. I'm of the Louis Vertel school where you can say the film is bad, but you can never say that she's bad in the film. And there might be an exception out there. There probably is. But
my pick for bad Anne Hathaway performance is, of course, the one she won the Academy Award for.
Yeah.
Was that Les Mis?
Yes.
Yeah, that sounds like it was probably bad.
But the she was going for it.
She was.
So you can't.
There were no half measures.
You can't diss the commitment.
No, indeed
right.
not.
So,
if you didn't see, was it Gigantic?
That was a good one.
Was that what it was called? Was it called Gigantic?
Was it called Gigantic?
The
kaiju movie.
I don't know. Anne Hathaway is really tall monster. That's what I remember.
That movie. Yeah. See, Anne Hathaway is really tall monster.
Really
I took it with my parents to that. They did not like it. They did not get it at all.
Parents are tricky.
They are.
Sometimes parents just don't understand.
Yeah. Jinx.
The what is good about this film is Anne Hathaway and Rebel Wilson in a scene together.
Yes.
Either toppling over each other or making the other one fall off of something or butting heads in some way.
This is a movie where the throwaway gags are funnier than any of the big setups.
Yes.
Like any of the major plot-oriented, like front and center jokes are kind of whatever. But off in the margin somewhere, there'll be some silly little thing that's hysterically funny. Or like just the shot, there's like, okay, early on, Anne Hathaway's giving this sort of PowerPoint presentation of the sort of the different kinds of men that, you know, are like her victims and stuff.
Yeah.
And Rebel Wilson is sort of nodding off and bored. And Anne Hathaway just bleats an air horn in her face and keeps doing it, like holds the button down. And I was like, that's funny.
I appreciated their energy together.
Yeah.
And I appreciated how much pleasure they seemed to be taking in each other in each scene where they were together. When they were apart, it dragged. But they were great in the room together. Two in a room.
Nice callback.
So, yes. Is this good filmmaking? No, it is not. Is this a silly little diversion with laughs and, charming, presence from these two? Yeah.
This is the kind of movie that you watch when you have the flu or on a long plane trip.
Oh, yeah. On NyQuil, I would be really laughing at this a lot.
Yeah.
And thinking, well, that was, why didn't people go see that movie?
Because it's very, like, it's the French Riviera. It's very sort of sun-dappled and colorful. And
outfits are great.
Anne Hathaway has some great outfits. Yeah. But Candace Frederick, who reviewed it for The Wrap, pointed out that, you know, they don't play enough with the idea of what makes women con artists different from male con artists or like how they're getting a sort of feminist triumph out of fleecing these dudes.
Right.
Like they're marketing the movie that way.
And they say so in the film.
They say it once or twice, but they really don't run with that much, which is weird because this is actually the first version of the three that's written by a woman.
Yeah.
The original was Stanley Shapiro and Paul Henning. Dale Lawner wrote the remake. And now a woman named, I think, Jack Schaefer is her name. And she's also writing the upcoming remake of Black Widow.
Right.
Which is, that movie better have some, like, more feminist content in it, because that's,
Right.
You remember Black Widow?
No.
The one with Teresa Russell and Deborah Winger?
Oh, that one.
That one.
Yeah. She mates. She kills.
Exactly. Thank you.
I do remember it now. So I, I hesitate to, crap all over it.
Yeah, no, it's not... evil.
Also, you won't have to invest a whole lot of your life in it.
Oh.
It is...
it's like 85 minutes before the credits start rolling.
Yeah, and if you will stay through the credits...
you get a terrible Meghan Trainor song.
You do get a terrible Meghan Trainor song. Oh, my God.
Oh, but you're right.
Is there anyone worse than her?
She's so bad. I think she lives... I think she lives in, like, the break room at Kohl's. And she just sings into, like, a microphone, and that's the music in Kohl's. Or maybe Ross. Like, on Tuesday, Wednesday, she's at Kohl's. And then Thursday, Friday, she's in Ross. It's horrible.
Thank you. You summed it up for me.
Right? There is a button after the credits. You're right. This movie has its own shawarma.
There's an extended scene that takes place after the credits, and it's another take of a scene that's already in the film.
Yes,
but it's longer and goofier.
Yes, and it's not a blooper. It's an actual scene. They just didn't use it.
Right. So, yeah, it kind of sucks, but.
You could do worse.
You could do way worse. Yeah,
we didn't see Palms, but,
I'm feeling pretty Angelica Houston about Palms, quite honestly. And I haven't seen it yet, so someone convinced me that I need to.
Yeah.
But it gave me a bad feeling watching a trailer, because they showed us the trailer today before the opera, if that tells you anything about
the age group of who shows up for the Met in HD.
It made me feel depressed about...
Look, Diane Keaton.
I turn 55 next month. more of my AARP benefits are about to kick in. And by benefit, by benefits, I mean discounts at Denny's, which I'm...
Oh, look out, Denny's.
I'm living for it, right? But anyway, it made me feel bad about the idea of getting older, which I think is the opposite of what the film is supposed to make you feel.
Right.
It made me feel bad about the idea that, I'm sorry, you're 70 and you still have to go chasing your self-esteem? Shouldn't I be over that by now? Shouldn't I have my self-esteem by 70? Like, I pretty much think I have it already. But, like, what? Is there something I'm missing because I'm a dude? Is that what this is? It made me feel bummed out about getting older.
Well, you know.
Just looking at the
trailer. You never had to defer your dreams because of some man.
Oh, really?
I made your dreams come true. I fixed your life.
I came pre-fixed. What you talking
You're
about?
You're welcome.
All right. You saw Alonzo Drowning.
Yes.
You saw All Is True.
Yeah.
I did not. But I did watch good chunks of it while you were watching it here on the screener.
Uh-huh.
And I watched enough of those chunks of it to know that I don't care.
Yeah.
And that I do not want to see any more of it.
It is, this is Kenneth Branagh doing the Shakespeare, where he's finally playing Shakespeare.
You know? Oh, okay.
He's done a million adaptations of Shakespeare. This is the later years. It's after the Globe Theater is burned down. He returns to Stratford-upon-Avon, where he has been... You know, he hasn't spent a lot of time, so he's a bit of a stranger to his own family. His wife is Judi Dench. He has two daughters. He's still mourning the death of his son, Hamnet. This is a very sort of...
But what happens? What are they? What's it about?
Not much. I mean, that's the thing.
I walked past the poster today at the movie theater. It said he had one last story to tell, his own. I'm like, well, what?
Yeah,
what's happening?
It's about Shakespeare after he'd stopped writing, you know, mm-hmm. and so it's sort of about, and now the rest of the story.
But
and
what the, is the story?
Not much. You know, it boils down to like he wants to start a garden in Hamnet's memory. He thinks of Hamnet as having been this great writer who died too young. He finds out that actually it was his twin sister Judith who was the poet who had created these verses, and Hamnet just wrote them down. So like all this time he's made her feel guilty for having been the twin that lived when, you know, because she wasn't Hamlet, but really she was the one who did the writing that he kept extolling. So there are lots of fine individual scenes, like between him and the daughter, between him and Judi Dench. There's a great segment where Ian McKellen visits, and he plays this sort of big deal kind of, you know, gentry.
That was one of the parts I walked through the living room and watched.
Aristocrat, yeah. And we find out that, like, you know, one of the sonnets is about him, like one of the romantic-ier ones. And, you know, there's clearly this sort of, like... He is the other love of Shakespeare's life, but because the time being what it was, they could never really express it or anything. Yeah. But there were whispers about it, and who knows what actually happened. It's British people, you never know. That scene is great, and Branagh and McKellen, like, head-to-head are fascinating. And, like, I could see a whole movie that was just, like, that visit, you know.
That would be great.
Yeah, but as it is, this feels like, you know, when I remember in college, when I was... taking these sort of history of drama or history of theater classes, there was the thing they would always refer to, the well-made play, which was like, you know, and then we get a lot of movies that are the well-made movie, which is like, you know, they're handsomely mounted, they're well acted, they're, you know, they have a plot, they do all this stuff, but they, you know, and you leave and you think, ah, well, that was a fine play. What a wonderful play that was. But it doesn't mean anything. It doesn't carry any weight. It doesn't have any bite. It's not about anything. This movie ultimately doesn't, it feels like it's a well-made film. You know, it gets the period detail right. There's good acting. It's lit in a way that, you know, it's mostly sort of candlelight and sun through the windows. And, you know, it feels period appropriate. But you kind of leave with, and, you know, and I never stopped seeing Kenneth Branagh in a nose.
Oh, yeah.
Well, you know, he's wearing these like heavy prosthetics to look like that first folio, you know, portrait of Shakespeare. And it's like, if you're going to do that, at some point you have to, like Nicole Kidman at some point just is Virginia Woolf and whatever. But like, I never stopped seeing Kenneth Branagh in a nose. Sort of in the same way how in Murder on the Orient Express, I never stopped seeing Kenneth Branagh in a mustache. So, yeah, it's whatever.
Well, then, I just won't watch it.
Yeah, you'll have missed nothing major.
So, for the last film that we're going to talk about, we have a thing to ask of you guys, the listeners.
Because generally speaking, y'all remember what we've said better than we do. Like, people have quoted things on Twitter and emails. We're like, oh, did we say that?
Did we talk about that? While you were in Dallas.
Yes.
At the film festival, I saw Long Day's Journey Into Night, the new film from Chinese filmmaker B. Gan.
Yes.
It's the one with an hour-long tracking shot.
In 3D.
In 3D, that takes place in the second half of the film. I know that you and I had a conversation about this film. However, I cannot remember for the life of me if that conversation took place on the mic, on this show, or while we were waking up some morning in bed.
Or on one of the Patreon shows, maybe?
Or on one of the shows that are on Patreon. We casually mentioned it or something. Yeah. I cannot remember. And here's the other thing. Sometimes our show notes that I am responsible for giving to you, sometimes I leave films out of the show notes and then it's like lost. You know, I don't remember if we talked about it or not. So, you guys...
Did I already
talk about this movie on this show, not on one of the Patreon shows, because we do shows that are just for Patreon people, but did I talk about Long Day's Journey Into Night, Chinese language film, on Linoleum Knife? If I did or if I didn't, somebody please tell me. You can help by emailing dlelandwhite.
No. linoleumpodcast@gmail.com.
Okay, sure. Yeah, send it to the show email.
Yeah.
Don't send it to me.
Linoleum
podcast. I got enough problems as it is.
You do indeed.
Here's the other weird thing that happened. A film that we did not talk about, and I know we did not talk about, is, speaking of Judi Dench, Red Joan.
Oh, yeah.
And I...
No one seems to like it very much.
I dropped the ball. The publicist sent me a screening link so that I could watch it on my laptop, my computer.
Yes. Your electronic brain.
And then the screening link expired.
Ah.
So if I want to see it.
It's still at the music hall.
It's still playing at theaters in Los Angeles. And you know, Dame Judi Dench.
Yes, but apparently.
I do love that Dame Judi Dench.
Judi Dench is only at the very beginning, very end. Most of the movie is a flashback about her character in the 40s.
Do they digitally youngify her?
No, they do not. They do not.
That would be cool.
I wish, but no. Only gentlemen get that done to them, apparently. You have to be Michael Douglas.
That's true. Have you ever seen a woman get... Michelle Pfeiffer did get it in Ant-Man.
Yep, oh, that's true.
She did.
You're right.
So did a little bit Nicole Kidman.
Oh, that's true. In Aquaman. You're right. Okay, I take it back. So let us know, and next week we will either talk about Long Day's Journey of the Night, or we'll report your findings.
If I didn't, I really do want to talk about it, because it's a very cool movie. But I just don't want to repeat myself if we've already... Yeah. And have people be like, wait, I know what he said this already.
Did I dream it?
Yeah.
This is why we're so confused. Also, next week we're going to talk about Charlie Says, which we haven't watched yet, but we're very excited about. Our good friend Guinevere Turner wrote it, and it's directed by Turner's collaborator on American Psycho, Mary Harron. And Manola loves it, so we want to check it out.
Well, if Ms. Dargis likes it.
Yes.
Does that mean anything?
We don't always agree, but she and I dislike a lot of the same things, which I always enjoy, especially when it's something you like.
Wait, I have a question. This isn't completely relevant, but what's a movie that you two disagree on, like, extremely profoundly in terms of one of you likes it and one of you like really loathes it.
Oh, it's so funny that you bring that up because we just saw that film at the Arrow a few weeks ago. Claire Denis,
Beau Travail. Well, also, what's the one that Max Landis wrote?
Chronicle.
No, the other one. the one with K-Stew and
American something.
Yeah, okay.
That one. He loved it.
I did love it. So Kristen Stewart and
Jesse Eisenberg. Social
Network.
And what's his face?
Jesse Eisenberg.
What is the name of that movie?
American Idiot? I don't know.
No.
Yes, it's called American Idiot. I'm blanking on the title, but I loved it and you hated it.
Yes.
But again, we just saw Claire Denis. Let's not beat around the bush. Her masterpiece.
That doesn't speak well for her.
Beau Travail at the Arrow a few weeks ago, and I was, having the time of my life, and Alonso was, the steam was coming out of his ears, his nose, his eyes. Yeah.
Again, a movie I walked into thinking like, well, finally I get to see this movie I've been hearing so many great things about from Dave White. How exciting.
Well, I will say, what a letdown. I will say that one of my favorite movies is Dark Horse, which I know you two really also disagree on.
Dark Horse.
It's got Selma Blair, and it's about this guy in his 40s.
Todd Solondzo. Yes, Dark Horse. Dave's a fan. Dark Horse
so much.
I remember you guys disagreeing about it, but then I went and watched it, and it's one of my favorite movies. Anyway, carry on.
I love that film. Yeah. Just the most brokenhearted movie. And, yeah, I'll watch that again right now.
Y'all have fun.
Pasolini.
Yes.
Well.
Which has been knocking around for a while, right?
Oh. Since 2014.
Woo.
I'm not kidding.
No, I believe
this is a film from 2014. Here is...
Played everywhere else in the world but here?
Or... Uh-huh. Yeah. And it's out on home video in other countries in the world.
Wow.
Yeah. This is a film by Abel Ferrara. And it is about the last 24 hours in the life of Pier Paolo Pasolini. Now, do you know who he was? Some of you do. Some of you may not. He was a legendary Italian filmmaker, writer, poet, philosopher, political figure, communist, atheist, openly gay in the 60s and 70s, yeah. Which was like,
in Italy,
in a
very Catholic
country. In a low key, deadpan, defiant sort of way, like. Mm-hmm.
In that Gore Vidal kind of
way. I'm too good for all of you, that kind of way. This is not a biopic. Although if you did make a biopic about his whole life, you would have, a 12-hour documentary right on your hands, because he made The Gospel According to St. Matthew, he made The Canterbury Tales, he made The Decameron, he made Teorema, he made Salo.
Mm-hmm.
And
the Gospel, did you say The Gospel According to St. Matthew?
Yes.
Satyricon?
That was that's Fellini. Fellini.
Oh, yeah. Sorry.
In the same way that all this...
I tried.
Why don't you go get your joystick? In the same way that all is true is about the last period of Shakespeare's life, this is literally like, the last day?
His last 24 hours. Yeah. And Mr. Ferrara has decided to make it a kaleidoscope of experiences that take place in this 24 hours. Nothing really flows into anything else. You see him typing. You see him having dinner with his mother and the actress Laura Berti, who was in Teorema.
Pasolini is played by Willem Dafoe.
Sorry, I forgot to say that. You see him playing soccer with some local kids. You see him out cruising for sex. You see him interviewed where... And that's really the best scene. The best scene is the interview where he is sort of laying out, the doom that is coming to the world because we cannot separate ourselves, humanity, from our desire to possess, to take, to destroy. He says in the interview, and I think these are taken from transcripts of actual interviews, he says, hell is rising toward you. You're like, oh, God, dude, come on. Please, we need a little bit of hope. And he offered none.
Is this, by the way, is this movie in Italian or in English?
Yeah.
Okay.
It's in Italian, it's in English, and sometimes it's in Italian with no subtitles.
Oh.
Yeah. There are entire sequences where Abel Ferrara just said, you know what? They don't need to know what this is, what's being said here.
Is Defoe speaking Italian?
Sometimes. Huh. Yeah. But again, actual entire scenes in Italian with no subtitles. It was just sort of like, yeah, it doesn't matter that you don't know what they're saying. Just trust us.
Yeah.
Right. And you also see glimpses into his imagination, a novel he's working on, a film he wants to make. Now, the film he wants to make in his mind stars some old unnamed man, right? Well, in this film, Pasolini, that old unnamed man, well, he's not unnamed, his name is Epifanio. I'm looking that on IMDb right now, but he doesn't have an actor in his head.
Right. Ferrara has cast
Ninetto Davoli, who was also in Teorema, and who was also in the Decameron, and who was also in, I think, the Canterbury Tales. Like, he was a Pasolini actor.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And you also have an actor in this film playing the young version of Ninetto Davoli. Mm. So there's a lot of that going on in the film as well, a lot of referencing of things that, you know, if you're aware of his life and his work, then you know about that stuff already. So, didn't have a problem with any of that. I wondered where it was going and why, but then I realized, oh, I know where it's going. How are we going to do that?
Yeah.
And where it's going is, on the last day of his life, at age 53, he was brutally gay-bashed to death. To this day, some people say that it was a politically motivated assassination.
Yes.
But given the context of the rest of the film and the fact that there's not a lot of meat on the bones here. Mm-hmm. There's just, you know, scene of him doing a thing and of another thing and of another thing and of another thing. And not a story necessarily.
Fragments.
It's fragmented, yeah. What you get in the final moments is an extended, graphic murder.
Mm.
Where he is attacked by a group of men and obliterated.
So that's like the one concept the movie sees through start to finish.
Yeah.
Hmm.
Yeah. Now, I think that what Ferrara is trying to do is echo something out of Salo, because the film opens with shots of him editing Salo, and you see scenes of the torture sequences in Salo.
Right.
And I can't help but think that that's why he wants to end the film the way he begins the film, with Pasolini's own, you know,
gruesome murder.
Gruesome torture and murder.
Yeah.
This, of course, brings to mind the way Willem Dafoe dies in The Last Temptation of Christ. And in, you know, however many other films Willem Dafoe dies in an ugly way.
Spider-Man?
Not so much.
I'm just kidding.
I was like, how does he die in Spider-Man?
He gets stabbed by his own glider. His goblin glider comes in from behind, and he's trying to stab Spider-Man, and Spider-Man jumps up, which is a shot-for-shot remake of how he dies in the comic. So,
oh, nice.
Good job, Sam Raimi.
Now, see, I did not know that.
Yeah.
By the way, cool. R.I.P. Alvin Sargent, who wrote the adaptation of Spider-Man for Sam Raimi, also wrote Ordinary People and Julia, a couple of them. He's like a screenwriting legend. We lost him this week.
Right. So anyway, I was disturbed by the ending, even though I knew it was coming.
Uh-huh. And not disturbed by the substance of it, but by the...
Disturbed by the way it plays out.
Mm-hmm.
For me, the way it plays out is not as, you know, people attacking him for the substance of his life and his work and the, you know, very much antagonistic stances that he took in life.
Mm-hmm.
In his own words in the film, he talks about how you know, his work is often an act of refusal.
Hmm.
But his death in this film feels like one of those weird things, like gays don't go have sex on the beach with a stranger now. Because this will happen to you.
Hashtag bury your gays.
Yeah. And there is a very ugly cinematic historical tradition,
yes,
of queer characters
meeting untimely ends,
whether they are based on real stories, mm-hmm, or not, like at the end of Boys Don't Cry. Well, yeah. Brandon Tina dies at the, yeah, end of Boys Don't Cry.
Suddenly,
because in real life, Brandon Tina died.
Right.
But in fictional narratives,
sure,
as well, it's like, oh, we got to kill that gay at the, yes, end of the movie. You know, Sandy Dennis has to be crushed by a tree at the end of The Fox.
Yeah, Shirley MacLaine has to hang herself in the Children's Hour, and, you know, Sebastian Venable gets eaten in Suddenly Last Summer.
I wanted more of a pointed, frankly, personally, I wanted something more from this film to separate that true life, real life murder,
mm-hmm,
from every other murder of every other queer character in
90% of
movie after movie after movie. So it just sticks in my craw.
How do you do that is my question. How do you...
I don't know.
But
I think Abel Ferrara should know because it was his film.
This is the thing for me, Dave, is, you know, I just feel like, especially lately, there's a historical erasure going on about the way people, you know, people your age or even people my age, the way they used to think about gay people and the, yep, way they used to treat gay people as if they were always not homophobic and these types of things didn't happen in our own lifetimes.
Right.
So I appreciate what you're saying, and I haven't seen the movie, but I also kind of want mostly straight people to have to confront this history more than they are having to right now.
Yep.
Anyway,
so you want the ugliness to be there just so we don't pretend like it never happened.
I just feel a little bit like things are getting glossed over, and I think this is something that happens that America really loves to do. I think a perfect example of this would be a movie like The Help.
Yep.
Or movies that try to position any kind of racism or homophobia, yep, or history of intolerance
as a thing we fixed.
As a thing we fixed. Yep. Or not even that, just as a thing where... How can I put this? This is, okay, even the people that would be trying to help in The Help would still have some racist tendencies because racism is so pervasive. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yes.
I mean, that's not really germane to this conversation, but point...
Oh, it absolutely is.
My point just being, yeah, that I think that it's important to have...
To portray things the way they were.
Have a reminder of that from time to time.
I am absolutely fully in agreement with you. And I will even give you an example of the way this was done,
yeah,
with a gay character in the film Stonewall from a couple years ago. The ending of that movie shows the main character's mother,
yeah,
completely flipping a switch and traveling halfway across the country to go to one of the first gay pride protests in support of her son. And...
Like maybe, a year after the Stonewall riots, first Pride.
Yeah, play. Maybe somewhere that happened. But don't act like it happened a lot back then.
Yeah.
And a film like that, very much like a film like The Help, very much a film like Green Book, is taking historical, you know, atrocities and turning them into...
Feel-good homilies.
Yeah, mm-hmm, so that people can feel good about how they feel about things now by giving you an example of something... strange and anomalous that took place in the late 60s or whatever. And so I do not want to further go to your point. Again, we fully agree. I do not want the murder scene from this film to be erased. I do not want it to be softened. I want it to be contextualized more because we do have this history in cinema of films that
just punish
the queer at, yeah, the end of the movie. And so... Was Pasolini in real life punished for his life? Yes, he was. Give me more than just he picked up the wrong dude and took him to the beach for sex. I need more than that.
No,
don't skimp,
right,
on the brutality, because that's the way the world was.
Yes,
you know. people in my own family that I've had to explain stuff to about the presence of LGBTQ people in the world, you know, explaining that there was such a thing as the Stonewall Riots, explaining that, you know, no, there aren't more gay people now. We just aren't afraid of you guys anymore.
Right.
You know, it's stuff like that. But they didn't know, you know, they had to have people explain that to them. And if people need that kind of stuff explained to them, then they're going to need better films to talk about history properly. Sure. So we don't need movies like The Help, and we don't need movies like Green Book, and we don't need movies like Stonewall.
No.
And we need a movie like Pasolini to just give me like two more minutes of something that gives me a reason why this guy might have been chopped down at midlife.
Yeah. No, I hear you. That totally makes sense. But still worth seeing.
It
still,
ain't bad. Yeah. It's only playing in one theater in the United States.
Yes.
I don't know what went wrong with the distribution of this film. Mm. Because frankly, it's 5 years old.
Yeah.
And is just now opening on one screen in the United States this week. I don't know if they knew it was a hard sell, and it's a hard sell. Like, sure. you better go in knowing you're Pasolini, or you're going to think, who is this guy? And what did he do?
What Detective Pikachu was for me, Pasolini was for you.
Yes, exactly. Know your Pokemon before you go see Pasolini. Yeah.
Well, Kino Lorber picked it up, so even if it doesn't get a huge theatrical, they'll definitely be putting it out on Blu-ray and stuff. So so people will have a chance to see it. Speaking of Blu-rays, I'm very excited about the Shout Factory release.
This is our Blu-ray DVD streaming pick of the week. Yes. Well, not streaming, but
our Blu-ray pick of the week, and it's actually it's a pre-order pick of the week because it's not going to come out until I believe May 28th.
So it's got, what is it, like 2 weeks-ish?
Yeah, about 2 weeks.
Until it comes out.
But you can order it now.
But it's very special, and here's why. Take it away, Alonso Duralde.
So this is the first time that the wonderfully bananas 1968 Liz Taylor Richard Burton movie Boom has been released on Blu-ray. For that alone, I am thrilled enough. But on top of it, they have a commentary track by John Waters, who is a huge fan of the movie and who I think has really sort of kept its what reputation it has as he's kept it alive for all these years. So that's exciting.
Yep.
And then on top of that,
there's some guy in a special 15 to 20 minute segment.
Yes.
Talking about the history of the film.
Yes.
Who is that guy?
I am that bitch. Yes, I'm featured on the Boom Blu-ray talking about this movie and where it came from and why it flopped and why it still lives in our hearts and all these things.
It does live in my heart.
Yeah.
And it super lived in my heart the night of the Met Gala when Emma Chan showed up.
Gemma Chan.
Oh, sorry, Gemma Chan. Gemma Chan showed up. Wearing
a Tom Ford headdress,
a near replica of Elizabeth Taylor's headdress from the film Boom.
Yes, and she tweeted that that's who it was inspired by, and posted pictures of Elizabeth Taylor in Boom. So yeah, it's a movie that you know has a big foothold in the fashion world. Karl Lagerfeld actually worked on the film at the time. He was an assistant to Tiziani of Rome, who was the designer. that's the name. Who did Miss Taylor's outfits, which are doozies. This movie's...
They're glorious.
This movie's bananas.
They're amazing outfits. To see it. Everything about this film is incredible.
So I could not be happier that I am on it. I'm on an extra where they put my name in the Boom font. It's very thrilling.
Oh, yeah.
So
we already have our copy.
Yeah.
And when it comes out, if you pre-order, you can get one for yourself. Or you can get one from us.
That's right. We're giving one away.
We are giving one away. You had a terrible idea for a contest. And so...
Fine. What's your great idea?
Well, you know what? You know I love an essay contest.
Okay. Here we go.
As we have done many times in the past, we have essay contests. Where if you can tell us in, 100 words or less, more if you feel like you have to go on, Tell us why you believe the film Boom is called Boom.
And feel free to be creative.
If you're the winner, and the winner is utterly subjective. This yes. is an absolutely subjective contest.
We will pick.
There is no objectivity going on in this. Entertain us. That's the answer. That's the answer. Are to we, the, do to we the, what we want?
Do we want to limit this to the United States since it's a Region 1 Blu-ray?
It is a Region 1, so please, if you live in another country, it won't work for you anyway. Also, shipping it to you will cost a lot of money.
Yeah. So, United States, U.S. residents only.
And there's no guarantee it'll get there.
Exactly. We love you, international listeners, but this one's not for you.
If you're an international Patreon person, however, it thrills me to ship things off to you.
Yes.
Even if it gets completely lost in the mail like it did once. more than once.
Anyway, Boom, Shout Factory, out May 28th. Please pick it up. And speaking of our Patreon, hey, why don't you go check out our Patreon at patreon.com/linoleumknife. We have 3 extra shows for listeners.
Yep.
We have hangout opportunities. We have personal podcast opportunities. We have shirts. We have all the things that you want if you want more from this show. So patreon.com/linoleumknife. Support us. Pay us. You'll be happy you did.
I'm happy I do.
And Mr. John Gutzer is now a super gay Patreon.
There sure is. Patreon.com/supergays with a Z. G-A-Y-Z. And we have many similar things. We have a podcast called the John and John Comic Book Hour where we talk about more contemporary comic stuff. Super Gay is kind of like a gay history and comics podcast. But John and John is a little bit more contemporary. We just talk about whatever's going on. And then I also have a podcast, a real doozy of a podcast called The Sharing, which is about the Animorphs Pulp Fiction novels of my youth.
Oh.
Yeah, and you can get lots of things if you subscribe, copies of my book. You can get on our Super Gay Discord. So yeah, check us out.
Johnny, thank you for being here. We always love having you over.
Oh, I love it.
Where can people find
one
you?
One of my favorite guests.
Where can... Johnny, you're my favorite customer.
That's right.
Where can people find you on social media?
I would say you can find me at Top Notch Gamer, like gamer, but with a Y between the A and the M, on Instagram and Twitter.
Excellent. So if again, subscribe to Linoleum Knife, and you will throw in Super Gay at no extra charge.
That's true, yeah.
So thanks for being here. Thank you for writing all the stuff for this week for the wrap.
Oh, gosh, and thank you for being patient with me when I needed a couple more days to watch the last of those 20 movies.
Yeah, that was a staggering list, so I totally get why you would need the extra moments. Anyway, so that's the show. Check out our friends on the internet. I'm not going to list them all this week. You know.
Pretty much, yeah, you know.
Or listen to another episode where I do, and you'll find out. Subscribe to the program at Apple Podcast. Did we read the 5-star reviews last week?
We did.
Okay. So, yeah, leave us a 5-star review. We'll read it on the show.
I want more of them, though.
Yes.
So get on it.
So love all the people who've already done it. If you haven't, get on that. You can also leave positive feedback.
It's never enough for me.
You can also leave positive feedback.
I'm never satisfied.
In all the places that we stream, like Stitcher Radio and TheLounge.com and Spotify and Google Play and CastBox and Podbean. Matt Severson left us a nice comment on one of those places. I was very...
Really?
That was so lovely of him. So, yes, more of that, please. You can follow us at LinoleumCast on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. Drop us a line at linoleumpodcast@gmail.com with questions or comments, whether or not we talked about Long Day's Journey
tonight.
Yeah,
I need to know. There is a memory of a conversation with you in my head. I just don't know
where. Yes, we don't know. Was it on a mic, off a mic? No idea.
Yeah.
And check out my other podcasts, Breakfast All Day, which is we're on YouTube, or you can, in all the places that you find your podcast. And, of course, Who Shot Ya on the Maximum Fun Network. So,
there you have it.
All right. Excellent. Everybody have a good week. We'll catch you next time. Until then.
Goodbye.